Welcome to the Steve Stein Guitar Podcast, brought to you by GuitarZoom.com. If you want to improve your guitar playing, keep listening. If you want to improve even faster, go to GuitarZoom.com, where you'll find all of Steve's premium courses, masterclasses, and memberships that'll help you quickly and easily improve your playing. Now, here's your host, Steve Stein.
Hey, this is Steve from the Steve Stein Guitar Podcast, and today we are talking to Owen Grover. How you doing, buddy?
Great to be here. Thanks, Steve.
This is awesome. So just a little bit of background for you. Owen is the CEO of True Fire Studios. Now, if you don't know what True Fire Studios is, it includes TrueFire.com, which I'm sure you know as a guitar player. You've probably heard of that. Jamplay.com, ArtistWorks.com, which I've been a member of all of those before. And then I was doing a little research. Is there an EDM.com as well?
Yeah, Fader Pro, focused on dance music, techno, breakbeat, house, you name it, all of that.
Cool. So you just became the CEO of True Fire Studios last year, is that right?
That's right.
Okay, cool. So we're going to come back to all of this stuff and talk about Owen's journey. But what I always love to do, first of all, just give us a little bit of background of where you're from, where you're living at this point, that sort of thing.
Sure. So I'm an East Coast guy. I grew up in and around New York City, went to high school in Montclair, New Jersey, went to college in Manhattan, lived in Brooklyn since the mid-90s, grew up on music, grew up taking a $3 bus from the corner of my house to Port Authority, get on the subway to go downtown, go to a CBGB's matinee as a 13-year-old with a fake ID. I don't recommend it, but back in the 80s, things were different. Seeing bands like Agnostic Front or Corrosion of Conformity, all of the great 80s punk metal thrash bands, Bad Brains, Youth of Today, Gorilla Biscuits, Judge, and I became friends with those folks. But a big part of my identity as a kid was finding that family you choose, people who love the same music you love, care about the same things that you care, share that passion for that whole DIY scene. And punk, hardcore, and metal were just, they're my heart. That's where my love of music was really birthed. And I've just carried that with me every step of the way. One of the fun things about True Fire Studios was discovering that Alex Skolnick, one of my heroes from Testament, is an incredible teacher, not just an incredible guitar player spanning so many different genres, but of course, I'm a kid listening to Practice What You Preach and his incredible fretboard virtuosity, and then get to work with him in a different way on the music education front. That to me is such a great indication of this journey for me, because what started as passion, right, and identity has also become something where I can make a living. And how blessed am I for that?
Gosh, I totally. And it's amazing too, because you're right. It's weird when you're on that side and then all of a sudden you're on this side and like you're calling some of these people and you talk to them and you see them at the trade shows. And so many of them are just like you. They're really nice and they want to hang out. And I always tell people it's so weird, like me being from North Dakota, it's who would have dreamed that I'd be doing what I'm doing right now. And I feel the same way. I'm incredibly blessed, but it's just always amazing to me when you meet people and you realize as larger than life as they seemed when you were a kid, they're thankful to be doing what they're doing as well.
Well, they always say, don't meet your heroes. And I always push back against that. When you do what we do, particularly when you're talking about rock and metal and punk, these are some of the most down-to-earth people you'll ever meet. That's because those scenes were not just about going to see the band, but it was about the community. It was about the togetherness that those scenes engendered. Those were real communities, right? Of people who felt at home listening to music together, sharing those experiences of being at gigs, being at live shows, whether they were matinees or bigger gigs, or going to the Meadowlands to see Metallica with Queensryche opening up, touring in Justice for All, and Queensryche's touring Operation Mindcrime. And maybe you don't get to meet the band there like you would at a club show, but you get to interact with all the other fans and you feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself. And to me, that's what it's all about.
It's funny too, because you talk about hardcore metal. You're right. The communities in those things, you'd go to a show and there'd be the mosh pit and everybody's bashing into each other, but then somebody would fall down and somebody would run out and pick you up.
Pick them up.
Yes. And it's interesting how metal and hardcore and things have this outside look to people that don't understand it. But inside, you're right, there's a real true community. I've always loved that.
You can't take the mosh pit out of the scene, right? The reason that the mosh pit works inside of that scene is because people know one another. And even if they don't know one another, they understand that this is a group activity and there's a community that you have to protect. when you throw a mosh pit inside of a group of people who've never seen each other at some music festival that's been kludged together with a whole bunch of acts that don't belong on the same bill together, or at least feel a little awkward together, that's when people get hurt. I mean, there's some recent examples of that. But at the end of the day, what I take out of that scene is the relationships. And that's what I brought with me into this role.
Very cool. Okay, what we're going to be talking about, because I'm very excited to talk to you about your early experiences with music and how that transitioned into what you're doing now, because it's just so funny. When I was doing some research on you, I think about how, again, growing up in North Dakota, I play guitar since I was 13. And then when I was 17, I had my first guitar student, and I realized that I had a skill of teaching. And I also realized that I loved teaching. Like, I loved being able to reach people. So I worked as much as I possibly could, playing in bands and teaching and all these different things. And of course, like most people in this music industry, you run out of time. Like, you're working so many hours, there's no time for anything else in your life. So I was like, how do I move into this technology? Because I had this thought in my mind, well, instead of teaching one-on-one lessons, what if I could go online and I could teach 100 students around the world and maybe not work as much and actually see my wife and my kids? And that's where all this stuff started for me, was with that one little thought of, could I use this thing called the internet? And I knew nothing about marketing. I didn't know anything about anything, but just trying to make this work. So it's going to be fun to hear your conversation of your transition from what your love of music, because music and technology, software, all these things for me, I love it all. I love technology just as much as I love music. So I'm looking forward to hearing you talk about this.
If I can jump in, I was working for a music production company right out of college in the mid 90s on a job that I got out of the Help Wanted section of the New York Times. Dear listener, this was a thing once upon a time. You could go into a newspaper, see job listings, call a phone number, and maybe get an interview. And that's how I got this job. And I was working with a whole bunch of Japanese artists who would come to the States to work with American producers. Now, a lot of these Japanese artists, and the one that I worked with most closely in particular, were working inside of R&B and soul music, which is funny to think, but actually there was some extraordinary music coming out at that time. And a lot of them really felt strongly they wanted to work with American producers or songwriters, right? So had the opportunity to work with The Roots, Raphael Sadiq from Tony, 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 a whole bunch of really great artists, and reinforced my love for incredible R&B music. But I remember once one of the really passionate fans of the artist I was working with gifted the artist a website that the fan had created for them. This is in 96. So the web was just starting to come online and be more available to people through dial-up modems or AOL or what have you. And they basically handed it to me and they said, okay, so Toshi has been given this website. What do we do? And took a crash course. Downloaded Dreamweaver, whatever it was, the product that I was using at the time, HTML editor, the WYSIWYG editors. And it was very early, so there were a lot of very funky tools out there. But I realized, oh my God, we've got a person halfway around the world who's communing with their favorite artist through this act of almost art, right? But art and technology, or you might say technology-enabled art. And it was such authentic sign. It was them saying, I love you and I want to give this gift to you and take you into the new world with me. But to me, it was this moment of like, wait a minute, there's something here. And then there was another moment when we were working with another artist and we started to pass the work parts, the different tracks and stems via internet. And we're like, wait a minute, they don't even have to be in the same studio. Oh, we've got a twisted pair copper line that goes a little bit faster. It was called DSL. I don't know if anybody even remembers that. It's faster than dial-up. It cost a lot of money. But we're like, oh, okay, we're downloading these work parts and we're going to load them into like Pro Tools 1.3, right? Because that's how early it was. And it's just changing the game. And it was that moment. It wasn't all at once, but a year or two or three of me going, technology is going to absolutely reinvent the way we think about, create, compose, distribute, and listen to music. And once I figured that out, I'm like, this is where I want to be. Put me right at the intersection of music and technology and let me play in that space for as long as I can play there. And by the way, you're going to have to cart me out in a coffin because this is what I love to do and I hope to always be doing it.
Well, and it's funny too, you say that. I mean, Dreamweaver, I completely forgot about until you said that. Again, growing up in North Dakota, I'm 3 hours from Minneapolis. And Minneapolis is where you have to go, certainly when I was younger, to get anything worth anything. So we're talking, like you said, the early 90s. So I'm trying to learn Cubase. I was always a PC guy, and I drove to Minneapolis. I got Cubase. I bought a couple of books. I'm trying to learn how in the hell this whole thing works. And it's also confusing. And I think about the transition from both Dreamweaver and Cubase in those early days, and how trying to learn from just manuals, because again, you're talking about, we're pre-YouTube at this point. There's no information to try and learn these sorts of things. I don't remember what the date was, but sometime in the late 90s, early 2000s, must have been in early 2000s, I started trying to just get my name on any website where there'd be like lessons. I didn't know how to do anything else. And then I started posting videos on YouTube, not knowing what I was doing. And the videos were embarrassingly bad and things like that. But I always run into people now who are content creators that call like me, Marty Schwartz, these guys, grandfathers of YouTube guitar. You're doing it so long, but you didn't know what you were doing. Like Marty, you probably know Marty Schwartz too, but Marty had the sense of marketing to go, you know what? I should make a bunch of videos and make them consistently every week and teach people how to do things, where I was just throwing stuff out there to see what stuck. But you're right. It's amazing. And you think about the last 15 years and how dramatically things have changed. And now since COVID, so many people have just converted to being online. You look at TikTok, all the thing. You know, now we're almost trying to rush to stay connected to all of these platforms. Like as an artist, you're almost obligated to post constantly on all of these platforms to stay relevant. Because if you take any time off, man, you're gone.
Yeah, the algorithm definitely punishes you for that lack of consistency. Makes me think of a few things. One of them is, if you were an aspiring filmmaker 10, 20, 30 years ago, you had an opportunity to go to film school or maybe did a DIY project with your friends. But that stuff that you were making when you were in your quote unquote apprentice period never made it into the universe, right? Until you actually got a movie out, distributed, you had business partners to help you with all of the marketing and the promotion and the placement, right? The creator economy is exactly the opposite. You, even Marty, before you knew what to do, you were trying and failing in public. And those best practices that we think of as second nature now, consistency of posting, knowing who your audience is, thinking carefully about your thematics and thinking carefully about the format of your videos, beginning, middle, and end, telling a story. Those are emerging best practices that are hard won based on people trying and failing over the course of the last 10 years. The thing that I love about the emerging platforms is that there are new innovations and new innovators and new creators who emerge out of every one of these things. We will post stuff on TikTok. It will just take a segment from a lesson, right, with the synced tab, and you'll see the play. It could be any one of the educators we work with. And then occasionally you'll see some kid, duetting, because TikTok has a duet feature, right? Duetting, playing the lead over the changes. Split screen, and you see our professionally produced educational product and some kid with a Kramer just barreling up the neck. Right? And you realize, hey, this is an innovation. This is a creator who is leveraging their own skills and talents for sure. But there's this thing inside of TikTok called duets that creates an entirely new affordance and opportunity for people to express themselves in partnership with other creators. And that to me is where things get exciting, because every one of these platforms is another way to connect and communicate and create that sense of community that we talked about earlier when we were just warming up, right? Because the communities around music that existed when we were young, they don't exist in the same way. And genre differences have certainly, I think, been worn down. Certainly, I think, for younger generations. But where does that community exist? It exists on these platforms.
Yep, you're absolutely right. I hope you're enjoying this episode so far and you're getting motivated to take your guitar playing to the next level. Please do me a favor and leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. It'll help the show grow and reach more rock stars like you who want to improve their guitar playing. Also, I'd love to know what parts of the episode you liked, as well as what you learned. So please share this podcast and tag us at guitarzoom.com on your social post. And now, let's get back to the podcast. Okay, well, gosh, this is just cool. Let's go back now. What we're going to do is we're going to move all the way back, because I love to talk about the early stages of what your experiences musically were and how that formulated into who you became. And then that transition that we just talked about of seeing the future, and whether it was by accident or whether it was intentional, whatever it might've been. But if we go back now to you being a little kid, you're living in New York or near New York. You were living where exactly?
I was living in Northern New Jersey in a town called West Orange.
Perfect. So what are your early experiences of music? Were you made, like, how old were you when you made some sort of a musical connection and you went, music is important to me? Can you remember an early instance of that?
Oh, I can remember so many. I can remember taping songs off of the radio on a boombox. I was really blessed in that I had an older brother who was quite a bit older than me, 7.5 years. So it wasn't like he was out of the house. So we shared time in the house together, but because he was so much older, he was much more sophisticated in his tastes in music. And he had an incredible record collection. Now, he was loved all the different kinds of music, but as he got a little older, he particularly was into new wave and a lot of the sort of first wave punk stuff. So my first exposure to The Clash, I remember seeing the Combat Rock cassette in his collection and taking that and listening to it and just having it blow my mind. It blew my mind not because of the hits. The hits, as you know, were on MTV, right? Rock the Casbah was in heavy rotation on MTV. But there were other songs on that record that had more of a dub or a raga vibe to it or a completely different feel. And I got this exposure to music that was a little off kilter. And I realized, hey, you know, it's great to see the stuff on MTV. And MTV was such this monumental force in our lives as kids. But it just made me very curious to start to dig into stuff that was a little more outside of the norm and outside of the mainstream. And I started going to shows on my own when I was 13. And the all ages shows then were 16 and up. I got a scuba diving certificate and it had my date of birth on it. And I changed the 3 in 73 to a 0 with a little stencil kit. And it just so happened that the doorman at CBGB's had been, or at least he claimed he was, had been a Navy diver. He was a very gruff, very scary guy. And I showed him this. He's like, oh, you scuba dive? And he just took a liking to me. And I wasn't a very old looking 13-year-old. That was a scrawny, scrawny kid. But I had my combat boots, right? And I had my punk t-shirt and my jeans, and he let me in. And that for me was one of the transformative moments. And I think also the other thing about it that I really reacted to was the danger of it. I grew up in a pretty conventional East Coast suburb, about 15 miles outside of Manhattan. There were some people who had just lived in that as a bedroom community. Then there were a whole bunch of people who never left the town. It was like New York City could have been 300 miles away, right? And just lived inside of that world. And at a very early age, I realized that I wanted to be part of something bigger. And when I found that scene, that hardcore punk scene, like I was like, okay, I've found where I want to be and who I want to hang out with. So for me, there wasn't one moment, there were moments. The first time I played in a band in the eighth grade, we were doing covers and, you know, we used to fight because those guys in that band loved like Grateful Dead and a lot of classic rock stuff. And I thought that stuff was fine, but I was trying to get them to play stuff that was a little more upbeat, a little harder. We did a cover of Stepping Stone by the Monkees, which I found out later, because at the time I didn't even know that Minor Threat had covered, and you can play that really loud and with like a punk flair to it. So I was trying to push them. You know, we played I Will Follow by U2, which I like because U2 has that almost punky vibe to it, right? But that was another moment. It's like, oh, I can play, I can actually make music. And that was me at 12 or 13, and that blew my mind too, right?
What instrument did you play?
So when I started, I sang, right? I had pretty good pitch. I was one of these people who just like the lyrics would just stay in my head. I was just lucky that way. I didn't really, it's not like I sat there to memorize lines. I just would hear songs over and over again. They stuck with me. I could hear the melody and the true pitch of the melody, and I could see the lyrics in my head. That's where I went to. But around 14 or 15, I was like, guitar is a really cool instrument, and I want to pick it up. And so I've been a learner ever since then, and I would say that I'm no better than a late beginner, early intermediate, but it's been something that's very important to me and part of my routine.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, the style of music you listen to, like when you move from the punk hardcore thing to the metal thing, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but in some ways the technique escalates at that point. We were talking briefly about Master of Puppets. Like Master of Puppets, when I was a kid, I grew up, the first big shocker for me was Love Gun. I went over to a cousin's house and he had the album Love Gun by Kiss. And I looked at that and I was right at the age where I was still, you know, playing with G.I. Joe toys and whatever. And I saw them. I just immediately went, and then he was playing the album for me. I was transported to another world and I went, this is what I want to do. So studying, because again, growing up in North Dakota, there wasn't a lot of teachers, that sort of thing. So when I started playing, you learned how to play by ear. So everything was visual. And you could hear, when you would listen to songs, you could hear similarities between songs and how those patterns would work. And I think so much of that formulates how you think about music, even as a singer. So moving from that music into metal, and you had mentioned, which is really great for me, you had mentioned Master of Puppets. I remember trying to learn how to play that, and I could only alternate pick it because I couldn't play it down. And a friend that went, dude, you're being a punk. You have to play it down.
James Hetfield, famous all the way down, baby, all the way down.
So I sat and busted my ass learning how to play that thing down because that's how you were supposed to do it. And that came from those early punk, like I'm a huge Ramones fan. So it came from that element of being able to play down picking very fast. It had never occurred to me that you should do it for a reason, like not just because you're a punk, but because that down picking gives you a different accent than alternate picking. It sounds completely different, just like the way you play drums. So anyway, you're learning how to play guitar. Did you take lessons or did you just learn on your own?
No, I did exactly what you did, which was that I had a whole bunch of friends who were self-taught. So they would give me pointers, show me how to form a bar chord properly, give me a sense of how to play open chords, how to play bar chords, understanding the neck a little bit better, how to tune, that sort of stuff. But it was all self-taught, listening. Let me get the melodic line. Can I figure out what the chords are? And of course, I had no technique and I didn't understand any of that. Now, later in life, yes, I did what everybody did, which is kind of ironic because it really informed my entry into this role that I'm in. But yeah, I live in Brooklyn. There's coffee shops everywhere like there are in most towns. And there's a picture of a guy with a Xerox headshot and you tear the number off the bottom. It's like the Lionel Richie, hello, is it me that you're looking for meme, right? And I called the guy and he was weird and awkward, but he was a lovely guy. And he would come to my house and we would play together for, and he really pushed me. And that's where I really developed a lot of true understanding. And I would say to him, hey, I want to check out this song. Can we figure out how to play this song? Or, and things that were interesting to me from a technique perspective, rather than I was not necessarily always a huge fan. It wasn't like stuff I was listening to for pleasure. It was like, this is going to help me become a better guitar player. There is a Southwestern band that I really, really like. And they have this sort of mix of indie, but also a little flamenco vibe to them. They're called Calexico. They're just a great act, right? And I was listening to that music, so not punk, right? But really beautiful musicianship. And I was like, well, I want to learn how to play this with all these flourishes and these really fast chord changes and almost flamenco style strumming patterns. And that wasn't so much about fandom. That was about curiosity about how to master the instrument. And pushing myself and just listening to one of your previous episodes and people who start in a certain genre or milieu and then they move because they want to push their craft forward, right? And I was thinking about, you were talking about Igor Stravinsky. Rite of Spring is about as metal as it gets.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's all palm mute is all, dun, 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 right? So that's like where fan curiosity, lifelong learning, self-actualization comes out of that. But first and foremost, you got to love and be curious about music. That's where it starts. And for me, I don't have to work at that. I'm blessed. I'm always curious about music. I hear a lot of people our age, oh, these kids today, they don't have Led Zeppelin like we had, or they've got some pale imitation called Greta Van Fleet, who, by the way, I think are pretty cool, so on. I always feel to be like, you're not trying hard enough, right? Whether it's folks our age who are continuing to push boundaries or young kids who are coming in and doing something new. If you're not curious, then you're missing. What a restrictive way to live your life.
It's funny because with social media, there are a slew of hotshot, credible guitar players, half my age. So it's funny when you meet people and they go, well, there's nothing happening in the music scene and nobody plays anymore. And it's like, no, no, no. There's all kinds of stuff. You're just caught in the wrong stream. You're floating on this river over here, which
you're in your filter bubble. You're in your filter bubble, right?
Listening to the whatever local radio station that's feeding you the same thing. There's so much incredible stuff out there. I was going to go back to what you said earlier. When I was learning how to play and I got metal was my home. That's where I felt connected and the music that I listened to. And it's funny because there's so much great music that came out of the 80s because I was born in 1970 that I bypassed because I was a metal guy. I was connected to that community, dressed the part, all of those things, and practiced and worked on my shredding and all these things. And then when I got older, I went back and found all these great bands of the time that I didn't listen to, the MTV generation bands I was familiar with, but I wouldn't listen to them because I was a metal guy, and then go back. So I can go back now and re-experience all of these bands, all of this different music that I didn't listen to at the time and appreciate it so much more now that I'm older and I view music completely differently. I view my guitar playing very differently than I did. I'm very glad that I spent 10 hours a day practicing scales and that because I can do it now. Lacking melody, lacking phrasing, like all these things that I never really thought about as a kid because everything was based off power and speed and all these things. So it never gets boring for me. Like every day I wake up, I'm excited to grab a guitar and play because people will go, do you play banjo or do you play whatever? And I'm like, I can't even get in enough time to play the guitar every day, let alone start something else. I love it so much. It's a Pandora's box. It's just never ending, the stuff you can do. It's just
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And for me, because I had an older brother, I had a lot of that other music on in the background. But I just remember how dismissive we would be at the time if we felt like any of the acts that we liked were nodding towards commerciality or trying to break through. You realize now, looking back, how naive we were. People want to be successful in their endeavors, and their notions of what makes them successful will change over time. And the best thing you can do as a fan is to be supportive of the artists that you love. I mean, I can think of a recent example of this, which is that about 10 years ago, I was turned on to this Australian psych rock band, and they really were a psych rock band back then, called Tame Impala. Very, very old school throwback, super fuzzy, wah-wah, riff-driven music, and just amazing to me. And then he's had an incredible pop career in the last, call it 7 years, working with artists like Rihanna, putting out his own music that is much more dance music or disco-inflected or pop music-inflected. And his definition of what being a successful artist is has evolved, as it should be, because you can't stay the same person. You've got to grow, you've got to evolve. And he can still shred, right? That doesn't, he plays every instrument on those records, right? He wrote every one of those killer riffs. That's still the same guy who wrote that elephant riff, right? That's still the same guy.
That's right. And now that we're older, we understand this. And so that's when right. You look at someone who's younger or has that mentality, you're like, are you the same person you were when you were 20?
No.
Of course not. I mean, talking to somebody, nobody is. So if you're an artist, there's only so many times you can do the same thing. At some point, you want to do something else. It's not easy to have a career that spans 10, 20, 30, 40 years. So I just think like Metallica, I was thinking about Metallica's Black Album and how that was a pivotal, it catapulted their career, but it took all these other people and they looked at it and went, well, this sucks. And I always thought what was so cool about the Black Album was that all the predecessors, and I love them all, Metallica is one of my favorite bands, but really were just multiple songs all put together in one. And then they finally just went, instead of writing four songs and making it Leper Messiah, let's just chop it into four pieces and make four different songs with it. And for me, that didn't bother me. I don't have a problem listening to a song that's 3.5 minutes long versus being 9 minutes long. It's okay that it's only 3.5 minutes long.
Look, at the risk of making this into a Metallica podcast, I mean, I think about those first four records as really being an era, and even Kill 'Em All is an outlier because it's much more British new wave of heavy metal. It's a little more riffy. It's not quite as sort of clockwork mechanical as, say, And Justice for All, which is a very different direction and has no discernible bass track in it at all. But if you look at the way that those middle two records, Ride the Lightning and Master of Puppets, are sequenced, they're sequenced identically. Where does the instrumental show up? Well, it shows up the same place on both albums. Where does the power ballad shows up? Shows up the same place on both albums. Where does the title track show up? Same place on both albums, right? So the albums flow, and even the side one, cut one on both albums are like screamers. Actually, those albums are like twins. I think most people would agree that Master of Puppets is the slightly more elevated. They've had another album under their belt, a little better songwriting. Then you get to Injustice for All, and it's like they forgot. There's no swing in it at all. You're right on top of the one. It's like metronome music. It's all treble and mid. It's all mid-range. And those songs get super technical. You were mentioning they're 7, 8, 9 minutes long. And at that time, like I was listening to stuff like Voivod and Celtic Frost or even Queensryche on the more traditional metal side or the proggy stuff like Dream Theater. So that was part of a piece of that era. But then you get to the Black era, you know, the decade shifts over. They want to bring some of that live feel back. They know that they can swing a little bit. And they've forgotten that these riffs are essentially blues riffs. They rediscover that. Bob Rock is like, you're a rock band. Don't forget, you're a rock band, right? I want to hear the instruments. I want to hear the pocket between the drummer and the bass player, right? And that was unlocked an entirely different opportunity for them. And, you know, the funny thing, of course, is Sad But True might be the heaviest record they ever cut. I mean, is it drop C? It's super low. It is a dirty, filthy, in the mud record. In some ways, their most accessible album. And then went through their trials and tribulations after that and had a return to form and so on. But that's to me so fascinating. And it's such a good illustration of what you said before. If you're not growing and evolving, you're busy dying.
That's right. Well, and it's funny too, because I've been in a lot of different bands in my life. I was in a band. What we decided to do is we're going to be a Metallica tribute band, in that all we would do is choose the most insane songs, like Fight Fire with Fire and Dire Thief and whatever. And we'd play all those songs. When you're in a band and you're learning songs, oftentimes you just, minus the limitations of maybe there's instrumental limitations or vocal limitations, you know, you can't sing like Brian Johnson from AC/DC or something like that. But if those aren't the limitations, you can play whatever the hell you want. So we're choosing these insane songs to learn how to play by Metallica. And one thing that we realized is that, unlike a Dream Theater or something like that, just what you just said, is that Metallica is a jam band. They're a rock and roll jam band. So when you're learning some of these songs, you can't look at it and go, what's the subdivision of that thing? Because it really is Lars staring at James, and then they're making this thing work. Sometimes the kick drum and the snare drum will be here, and then all of a sudden it'll be kind of flipped over, and you start realizing that it wasn't intentional. Like, they weren't masterminding this thing. They were jamming. Lars is being Lars, and he's playing with what's happening. I don't know that it makes it harder to learn, but you have to be aware of that going in, where if you're learning a Dream Theater song, it ain't like that. It is what it is.
They're down to the 32nd note. Like, everything there is super intentional. And again, it's like, what mood are you in? Where's your head at? There's some days where that music just can propel you. And then there are other days where it's like, I need something that's just a little looser. But there's so much great music out there. I think with these artists, a lot of these artists, and what I've learned, particularly over the last year and a half, is that a lot of these artists, by doing what they do, the in-studio experiences they have, the gigging experience they have, everything you're just discussing, this idea of the rhythm guitar player looking at the drummer and playing through the changes together sort of on the fly. So a lot of these folks that I've worked with, they think to themselves, well, I'm not really a teacher. I'm not an educator. And the truth is, you don't have to be trained as an educator to have something to contribute to guitar players, right? So I don't want to blow anyone out of the water, but, you know, we're talking about Metallica, we're talking about the Four Horsemen, Anthrax, Megadeth, Slayer, all bands that I love. Well, one of the people in one of those acts is someone that know the people at the management company, and I've reached out and I said, we'd love to have him do a masterclass. I think it would just be extraordinary. And the feedback that I got is, oh, you know, this is great. He thinks it's cool. He gets it. But he's self-conscious because he thinks of himself as a punk guy and he's not a theory guy. And again, I don't know if this will ever happen or if it won't. But what I'm really encouraging anybody who listens to this is, you don't have to know theory. You don't have to be so technically aware of what you're doing. Really, a lot of what people want to know is, how did you get that sound? How did you develop that? And to me, that's just as important, because at the end of the day, people talk about online education, right? And there's a difference between learning facts and information and imparting a skill. Totally different. If you go to TrueFire or JamPlay or Fader Pro, you're not going to be given a test, a multiple choice test at the end of the course. When was the Battle of 1812? Guys, we're about imparting skills. Skill learning is totally different. It's the connection between your fingers, your mind, your strum hand, your left hand, your right hand, how you're thinking, feel, timing. That is a physical skill that you're inculcating rather than a set of facts, figures, or knowledge that you're trying to ingest.
If you enjoyed today's podcast and want to learn guitar even faster, go to guitarzoom.com and click the Get Started button to get access to courses that are right for your interest and skill level. Again, go to guitarzoom.com and click the Get Started button.